Yes.
I have a question. So
okay, you have a question.
The last, discussion, last session about the noises, when the procedure that you discussed was about the unknown background noises that are out of our control, right?
That's right.
So you're excluding everything through the detector, that noise plot that you showed, but whatever we are getting from, out of the world, still, when they are not gravitational wave events, you're calling them as like stochastic noises or something? That is what you were trying to show?
So your question is, I've rearranged my slide ordering, so it might be actually really difficult for us to find the slide. So I'm going to try to repeat your question back to you. So you're asking, so the slide we showed of the time series with the dark blue and then the faint signal, is that the slide that you mean?
No, it was like something that you were trying to consider the correlation between two detectors and with the row of these and that one.
Ah, okay, so we had a whole bunch of little X's.
Yeah,
yes. Aha,
and...
uh-huh, yes. Okay, so the major point here, this is the way that we empirically measure the rate at which our detector noise would produce an equivalent trigger event. So we can essentially do slides in time. We don't even have to rerun the match filter analysis. We can just take those triggers, the times and SNRs of the triggers, and we can keep recomputing for those correlated triggers the network SNR, and we can just build up our histogram of background. That's essentially what the goal of that exercise is. And there's no other way to do it, really. Our noise is not possible to model. We'll understand that a little bit better shortly. But I wanted to jump in with what we've learned, a little bit about what we've learned so far in the context of multi-messenger sources or potential multi-messenger sources. So on the y-axis here, we've got the mass of a compact object in solar masses. The x-axis is distance. And we've got some handy reference points here, the Milky Way center, the edge of our galaxy, and then the Virgo cluster, so extragalactic. So the colors are meaningful. So anything in green, this is a black hole with a mass estimated electromagnetically. So these are usually X-ray binaries. So for purple, these are neutron stars with masses estimated electromagnetically, generally pulsars or neutron stars and binaries. Each one of the blue dots is a compact object with a mass estimated with gravitational waves. And we always expect them to come in triples, the two initial compact objects, the components, and then the final object. So you'll see these all with the same distance. And I want you to notice a couple things here. So gravitational waves have revealed this new high mass population that was not accessible to us with electromagnetic astronomy. So we're now revealing this new population of stellar remnants of these dead stars that have masses well beyond about 20 solar masses or 20 times the mass of our own sun. So I also want you to notice that these are much, much farther away. So gravitational waves, again, remember the amplitude scales is 1 over r. We have a vast, enormous reach in making these fairly accurate measurements of mass because of the scaling factor. And we also can see here a little bit of selection bias. So we expect just from doing population synthesis modeling of how often stars will be born and be born in binaries and then die and then have enough time to merge within a Hubble time, we expect binary neutron stars to be much more abundant in the universe than binary black holes. However, we're only sensitive to binary neutron stars out to about roughly 100 megaparsecs or so. Right now, at the time this plot was made, it was about 100 megaparsecs. Now it's about 160 at maximum. However, for these binary black hole signals, as they get more massive, we're able to see farther and farther out. So here we're seeing that selection effect as well. And as our detectors get more sensitive, we expect the shape of this will shift over in distance, but we always expect to see the same kind of selection effect, which we need to account for when we're trying to make inferences about what the true distribution is. Yes?
But why don't we see like heavier black holes below it? Closer to us, you know what I mean?
So the suspicion is, so if I focus on how often would I see a binary black hole merger with this mass, this is telling us that the rate of those mergers is rare, that they're more rare because we only see them at vast distances. This great question.
This is not a correlation, it's just Okay, the farther we look, the more we see, obviously, but not, it's not that the farther out we are, the messier, massive, the more massive the black holes get.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly right. Yes?
Very amateur question. If I remember correctly and vaguely, there is a gap in neutron star mass, and there was some news that something was observed there? Or?
Ah, yes. So I had a slide about this, but then I think I cut it in my fervor to get us to Lisa in pulsar timing. So that's right. So there are a couple gaps that people refer to when they talk about a black hole mass gap. One is between black holes and neutron stars, and this comes from the empirical observation based on compact objects in our galaxy. This is the data set that produced that empirical, let's say, hypothesis that there may be a gap here between the lowest mass binary, or the lowest mass black hole and the highest mass neutron star. And a lot of the theory, at least as far as I understand it from Vicky Caligara and her colleagues, tried to explain what seemed to be a pretty clear gap. But yes, you're exactly right. We have several events, in fact, with masses that are fairly well localized, fairly well constrained in mass to fall within that gap between about 3 solar masses and 5 solar masses. So this is where we need to accrue many more statistics, but it seems like we're potentially building up evidence that there's not actually a mass gap. The second mass gap is between the largest stellar remnants, the largest black holes that form from supernovae, and the supermassive black holes that we see in the center of galaxies. So the intermediate mass black hole mystery, where are all these black holes? How did supermassive black holes get so big? So gravitational waves, we hope, will answer the question of, is there seeding going on? Do we have a lot of binary black hole mergers happening in the early universe that where we're seeing hierarchical mergers that then form a supermassive black hole? So this event that you see with the mass all the way up at the very peak top there, this is the event that was widely circulated in the media as the first observation of an intermediate mass black hole, where there was a component mass that was heavier than we had predicted would be possible based on what we know about stellar evolution. All right, excellent question. Yes?
What's the meaning? You might have said this, but the dots versus the triangles versus the X's?
So it's the type of uncertainty. Let me try and see if I can remind myself what I did here. So the lines are the uncertainty bars, and I think X's, let me see. I have this in the paper notes, what the symbols mean, but it's either double-sided or one-sided uncertainty information was not available, just to kind of alert you to that. But yes, we have uncertainty bars for all of the gravitational wave sources. They're harder to come by for the electromagnetic sources. Yes, good question. Yes?
What was the electromagnetic black hole? I couldn't catch that.
The electromagnetic black hole masses are in green.
I mean, what are they? How can we observe them?
Oh, so they're in a binary. We can only observe them when they're in a binary. So we have dozens of examples of X-ray binaries where you have a black hole and some kind of a companion, where that black hole is accreting matter from the outer layers of the companion, and that produces actually a very bright source. But you can resolve both of the members of the binary and infer the mass. Yes, good question. All right. Okay, something I really wanted to highlight to you. So there's a lot of science that can be done with gravitational waves. It's very apparent to me that we can't even scratch the surface in our time today, so I wanted to give you some resources. So since the first discovery in 2016, we have published over 100 papers in the collaboration covering a very wide variety of topics, including tests of the speed of gravitational waves compared to light. I will direct you there because I don't think we have time to do that and squeezing and Lisa and pulsar timing, which I'm trying to prioritize. But if you go to LIGO.org and then click on researchers, you'll make your way to our publication page, where for each one of these papers, we have this really nice science summary. So if you want to know the explanation of the plots and the results of the paper in a nutshell, this is a really nice place to look. They're fairly readable and understandable, or at least I find them to be so. If you don't, please let me know, because that's actually really useful feedback. So this is a really nice resource, and this brings us to the current detectors. So we're going to get a little bit more of an overview. So here we're seeing the real footage. Oh, this is a different simulation than I thought it was. Okay, this is real drone footage though. This is really nice footage from the Science magazine, where we can actually fly above the detector just to get a sense of scale. It's actually more helpful than being there in person, because when you're at the ground level, you can't even see the mid station. they're so big, and even in fact, the end stations extend beyond the ends of the image in both directions. This is not the end station here. These are actually just trees. It keeps going. They're very, very large detectors. And here is a noise budget, which I did want to share to give you a sense of where we are and also introduce squeezing and why squeezing is important. So you might remember the shape of the curve, which is the sum of all of the noises. That's our noise curve in the dark blue color here. So we've got, again, displacement noise or strain noise versus frequency. And there are here, again, the three big noise sources. So seismic noise that you can see here in red, pushing everything up at low frequencies. And then we've got this quantum noise. There are two parts to quantum noise. One is photon shot noise, as we discussed before. The other, which is bringing this up at lower frequencies, is actually radiation pressure. So this is actually the photons pushing on the test masses in a way that introduces relative displacement to them, which is part of the reason why they're so big. We have to make them as heavy as possible in order to mitigate that effect. And then we also have this yellow line here. So this is the coding thermal noise, which if we don't figure out how to make less noisy coatings that wiggle around atomically a little bit less, but give us the same reflectivity, then we're not going to be able to push past this. So this is something that material scientists are working really hard on. So let's talk a little bit about squeezing. So one of the ways that we can push down this photon shot noise is by thinking about photons in a quantum mechanical way. So if we take no action, if we just let the photons propagate in the vacuum, essentially what we get in this distribution of amplitude and phase is we can visualize this as a circle. And the reason why I'm calling this out is because this is the analogy for essentially our quantum problem to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So instead of thinking about we have momentum and position, now here we're thinking about the phase of the light and the amplitude of the light. Those are our two degrees of freedom where we can't know both precisely at the same time. So what we can choose to do, and by we, I don't include myself in this. So we're gonna approach the limits of my knowledge very quickly in terms of quantum squeezing. But we can, what experts can do is they can squeeze, they can reduce the uncertainty in one of these dimensions. So for shot noise, which is this gonna be? Is this gonna be phase or amplitude if we're trying to reduce the uncertainty in the time of arrival of the photons? Which direction are we gonna wanna squeeze in? Phase, yes. And what's going to happen if I squeeze in phase, what's that going to do to amplitude? Yes, it's going to get a lot bigger. So this is going to actually introduce radiation pressure. So we call this squeezing in phase. This is frequency independent squeezing. And this works really well to reduce our high frequency noise at the cost of adding low frequency noise. All right, so here's an example. Here's another schematic showing you that's, so again, here in this, these two parameters here are phase and amplitude for us. But yes, exactly as we said, so lower uncertainty in phase means greater uncertainty in amplitude. And we can actually see this by taking a measurement. So this is coming from a LIGO detector. So we can take stock of what our noise is in the detector if we use this reference time in green. So this is, we're not squeezing anything at all. This is just for reference what the noise nominally looks like. If we squeeze in phase, we can see we do a lot better at high frequencies. So this is pushing down the quantum shot noise, reducing the uncertainty in phase. However, it is adding radiation pressure. It's adding uncertainty and amplitude at low frequencies. And then in principle, we should also be able to take this and rotate it 90 degrees and do the opposite. And we've also demonstrated this anti-squeezing effect just for fun. This is not a useful thing to do. It's quite a lot more noise, but just for fun, we've explored that as well. So the way to combat this was actually developed at MIT, which is frequency independent squeezing, where you're squeezing in phase at high frequencies, and then you're squeezing at amplitude at low frequencies. And the way that we can achieve this, this low frequency squeezing and amplitude, is actually by building a 300 meter long filter cavity. So the in the detector schematic where this would be, so here's our laser, here are our detector arms, and then we're adding into near our signal recycling cavity this additional squeezer cavity, which we're going to use as the reference to squeeze and amplitude. And we can do it with a smaller cavity, but it gets tricky then to inject that squeezed vacuum in and match it with such a high power source in our arms. It gets, so the engineering of matching exactly what the geometrical modes are for both of those sources gets very complicated, and any mismatch at all causes a lot of loss and can reduce the effectiveness of the technique. So here, just to give you a sense of scale, so here are the buildings. Humans are too small to see in this picture. You can barely see some cars here, but 300 meters, this was actually an addition. I'll give you a little bit of a tour. So you can see this is the corner station. So this houses the beam splitter, the laser, the photodiode readout. And here's the structure for this new 300 meter cavity. So brand new building, brand new vacuum enclosure, brand new structure to house the vacuum enclosure. And we have actually been able to use it to achieve this frequency-dependent, independent squeezing effect. So here's the same plot that we saw before. And now here is what we're doing now, where we have our reference, so that's in black. And then we have frequency-dependent squeezing. This is what we were doing before. And then frequency-independent squeezing, we're actually doing this quite a lot better now at low frequencies. So squeezing in phase at high frequencies, squeezing in amplitude at low frequencies. So this has now brought us back to seismic noise, which is a place, a territory that we already know very well. But you might notice maybe even just one more thing if I can add it. So what this squeezing ability has done is it's reduced our noise quite a lot at high frequencies, and now we're doing about as well as we were before in low frequencies. So this is telling us we're not adding any more noise. We don't necessarily expect to be doing much more than that because of seismic noise. There are other sources of noise in that frequency range. All right, questions about squeezing or thoughts? Yes?
It's not actually squeezing. So in lower frequency, the seismic noise is already large. Why do we care about lower frequency noise when we are talking about the squeezing? I mean, I thought we don't care about lower band, I mean, or less, few hertz frequency range, we are not going to expect anything in that range from LIGO or other range otherwise, right?
That is true. However, so if we take a look at this plot again, so it's not the few hertz range that we were adding noise. It is in an interesting, gravitationally wave interesting range of roughly about 50 hertz or so. So just above where the seismic wall is. Yeah, great question. All right. Well, I will move us right along to challenges, although I find squeezing to be really incredibly cool. So if you take all of this very impressive technology and even assume that it works perfectly, so on the axis of reality here, where we start from our very simple Michelson that we talked about before, by the time we get to actual reality, we have hundreds of thousands of moving parts. We have dozens of optical cavities that all need to be resonating. All of this needs to be controlled synchronously. And then you start to introduce the detector environment and changes in ground motion, changes in weather, wildlife. And I want to, I've given you a hint here, but I'd like you to take just a minute and talk with your group and see which one of these you think is the least likely to be a real noise source in one or more LIGO detectors. Yes, you may.
Birds, because they're sharp.
Ooh, that was a good one. That was a good one. I like that one. That was great.
LIGO's up north enough that they need to go
for the real noise.
How far are the detectors from 90? Because I remember
the word. So the detector in Louisiana is fairly close to the ocean. Yes, about 100 kilometers or so. Hanford's a little bit farther. Neither, I'll give you the hint though, that neither one of them are far enough to escape ocean waves.
Really? I thought that was going to be the answer, like ocean waves.
Well, it's not the individual waves. Yeah. It's sort of the resonance of the body of water. So when the waves pick up and that resonance increases, it increases the overall level of ground motion at the frequency, at that resonant frequency. You can actually see different peaks for the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific.
Really?
Yep. No, oh, they're a real problem. How are we doing up here?
Sorry?
How are we doing up here?
What?
You have any thoughts?
The radio parts are like very low frequency. They affect things, but not like we don't care about.
Yes, you're operating with incomplete knowledge though. So we do use radio frequencies to lock our signal recycling cavity and our power recycling cavity.
No, my point is that there wouldn't be a serious
on average, that's true. However, we're looking for transient gravitational wave sources, and you can have transient radio contamination that can mimic a source. Yeah, so we call them whistles, and they're actually a really big problem. How are we doing here?
There are some words I don't even know.
Oh yeah, which ones are those?
Forklifts.
Oh, that is, it's a great big piece of machinery that's meant to pick up really heavy boxes.
Oh, I see.
It kind of looks like a fork.
Snow globes?
Yes, so those are meant to push the snow off of the road, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to think about. Wow, there's a really nice resonance right here. All right, so I would like to reveal to you that I have tricked you. They are all real. And now that you've thought about this in this way, if you have any questions about your favorite one that you thought might not be real, please ask me. Yeah, wow, okay. Let's start over here and we'll move in this direction. Yes. Or would you like to go first?
Oh.
Okay. Sure, please.
Why is low humidity bad and not high
humidity? Okay, so low humidity is thought to be the partial cause of one of the worst forms of transient noise, the glitches that look the most like high mass binary black hole sources. We call them blips. Blips, yeah, static, exactly right. Yes, so we think when the humidity gets low that they're static discharging. It's much more likely that we're getting sparking in our electronics. So the HVAC systems are very difficult to change because you also need to keep them acoustically quiet and mechanically quiet at the same time. So we could control for humidity, but you don't want to be adding more pumps, motors, or anything else if you can help it. But yes, great question. All right, hire a postdoc. Just have them in the detector. That would help add humidity, I suppose. Okay, yes.
Are ocean waves a problem for both detectors? Only for
they them? Are a problem for both detectors. We were having this really cool discussion over here. So this introduces what we call microseismic noise, and it's not the individual waves that are beating up at the shore. If the wave motion is elevated in that body of water, it will start to resonate. And you can actually see the peaks. The resonant peaks will look different from the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific. So if you have a storm, the whole ground will start to shake at about that frequency, and it's actually a really big problem for us to maintain light resonance. Okay, I saw another hand. Yes?
Can you also explain logging?
Logging, yeah, yes. We had a, we may have glossed over this image, but in this drone footage, we got a snapshot of a whole bunch of an area where there weren't trees. And fun fact, Lago Livingston is in the middle of an active logging site. And once every 7 years, they will reharvest an area. And they've been pretty accommodating about working with us in terms of their schedule not overlapping with our observing runs when they're logging right next to either a test mass or the beam splitter or something really important. But yes, logging is something we think a lot about. Yes.
Two questions. One, how earthquakes would affect.
Was that earthquakes?
No, the forklifts.
Forklifts.
And
ah.
Second question. So one of these would be, solved by choosing the right location. In Saudi, for example, in the middle of desert, so many of these would be gone.
Okay, I'm going to hire you. We're going to send you to Congress, and you're going to convince them to give money to go to another country. Well, yes. So that is actually very. So the swamp in particular turned out to be a bad idea, as one might imagine. But there are a lot of factors that go into site selection, and one of the primary ones is money. Whose state is willing to host this and add the money that it takes to build it and all of the infrastructure and power and roads. And so it is, here we are. We have two detectors, they work very well. Livingston actually is the most sensitive and has the most uptime, so maybe I shouldn't be throwing any shade on the swamp. But it's a challenge, it's been a real challenge. You had a first question, I've completely forgotten it. Oh yes, so this was mostly just a mistake. We're not supposed to be operating machinery when the detector is observing. So this was a conversation that had to be had with a person who went into the the enclosure area and started the forklift. We have dedicated time for when you're allowed to operate forklifts or restart computers or do whatever it is that you need to do, and it's Tuesdays. If you ever hear a LIGO person complaining about Tuesdays, that's what's happening. All right, you've had your hand up for a long time.
I imagine radio contamination, telephone, introduce noise by introducing sparks in the system.
So the radio frequency contamination actually comes from the way that we control our signal and power cycling cavity. We use radio frequency modulation and actuation to keep the light resonance there. And when you have undesired and sources that we don't understand of radio frequency contamination, every time your controlled radio signal passes by one of those frequencies, it makes a screaming, loud, horrible beat note. And that actually sweeps up in frequency. And they're extremely challenging for the searches to handle. Yes. Yes.
If the birds are problematic, I guess other animals also are.
They're problematic in different ways. We've got the black widow variety, we've got the radioactive wasp variety, we've got the bird variety. But in terms of introducing noise into our strain data, birds have so far been the worst. Mice are sort of a slow degradation of the vacuum system. But yes, birds will actually introduce not chirps, but tapping. So the story here with the birds, this is a really good story. We noticed some rap, 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 and it would come, we called them storms. We were like, oh, the glitch storms are back. And they would, we'd get them periodically, and then they would disappear for hours or days, and then they come back, and finally somebody spotted a raven flying away, and it turns out they had learned that they could peck at the liquid nitrogen feed to get ice and drink. Yeah, so we did actually, we ameliorated this just by adding some netting. They're fine. There's a river right there. They're not that thirsty. That's yes.
Okay, two questions. First, radioactive wasp.
Oh, well, yes. So who's familiar with the Hanford site in the context of the Manhattan Project?
Oh.
Okay, a few of us. So yes, there is some old nuclear material that's at the site, and we are not allowed to move the tumbleweeds that are on the site, and the animals also sometimes can be exposed. In what way, it's not totally known, but there are a series of radioactivity detectors, Geiger counters, all over the site to try and account for this. They're always very normal. And then one day, one went off. It was a Geiger counter right above a trash can. And it turned out, yes, that it was the wasp hovering around the trash can.
Does anyone have any superpowers?
Not yet that I know of.
Second question is, are there any limitations to, other than operating a forklift, what an engineer or scientist staying on site can do to avoid, contaminating?
Yes, we're not allowed to operate motor vehicles within a certain distance of the control room and the beam splitter. You're not allowed to enter the facility area. It would be a good idea to not jump up and down. We have done that empirical measurement. You can see it in the data.
Wow.
Okay.
What? In the strain data, yes.
Where were you jumping up?
Sorry?
So just on that, where were you jumping up at?
In the control room, which is maybe about 200 meters away from the beam splitter. on a different concrete slab. Yes?
So, assuming, so we know all these sources of error, my point is that are we removing all of these light? I mean, as the data is being recorded, you're taking this away and then some clean output is there?
It depends. So if we have a very good witness, so for example, thunder and lightning, very good witnesses. We can predict essentially from the auxiliary sensor what the response will be in our strain data. Then we can simply filter it out. And there are a lot of, so if you look at LIGO data online, you'll see the clean version, and that's what's happening there. Some of these we either don't understand or they don't have witnesses. So I've managed to choose ones that pretty much all do have very good witnesses, except for low humidity. That's a little bit harder for the blips themselves. But we only do very deep cleaning when we have a glitch that's right on top of a gravitational wave signal. Yeah, something we really didn't get the chance to talk about is the analysis that goes into trying to estimate what the properties of an identified source actually are. And this is a fully Bayesian treatment that assumes that the underlying noise is Gaussian. So we work really hard to try to make that happen. We model the glitches, we subtract them. Sometimes it works well, sometimes it does not.
So regarding that, I wanted to ask in the previous session, I couldn't get a chance. So about also the match filtering, if you want to say this is an event or not, is that also happening live? And how long does it take from the detection to the report? For you there, I mean, if you are in the site to notice, okay, here it's a peak, maybe we want to go and study this part of the signal.
Yes.
There is a time delay, right? Because you want to do all this match filtering to see if there is anything happening.
So you,
I mean, is that happening also live or?
It depends. So we have some clever downweighting. So if you can predict what the effect of the noise is going to be in the lens of your match filter search, you can, so for example, one of the things we do is a simple chi-squared test. Does this data have the same distribution and power as you'd expect from a CBC? And if it doesn't, you downweight the SNR. It could still be significant, but it might not be. So that's one strategy. There are also machine learning aspects. I'll maybe just take a moment to advertise one that my group produces, which is called GW Skynet. Amazing name. And it takes the sky map and the coherence information in the sky map and produces an answer in less than a second. So it will return an answer to you very quickly, an estimation of how likely it is to be real or not. Yes?
So this is not related to noise, but I was wondering if you could talk at some point about salting.
Salting?
Yeah, salting your data.
Ah, I'm not familiar with the term, if you want to say a little bit more.
So basically inject a fake signal that somebody in the collaboration knows about just to test the analysis.
Yes. Okay. We used to call this blind injections. I'll just say a minute about this. So this is a practice that we did to prepare for the eventuality of a first detection, and was the reason that I was convinced that the first signal we did detect wasn't real. So I joined the collaboration back in 2007 as an undergraduate, and I experienced two of these exercises where, exactly as you said, some small number of people have generated a simulated signal, have injected it into the data as it would appear if it were real, and then the collaboration just goes on as normal. You run your search, you try to detect it, you characterize it. We actually wrote the paper, and it was at that stage we voted on whether or not to submit the paper to the journal, and then we opened the envelope to see whether or not it was real. And it's, I think, a really good thing that we went through the sociological exercise, because the first paper we did write, I think, was really beautiful. It was very clear and I think really compelling. But we don't do it anymore. Yes, especially after the kilonova detection. It feels like, to me, the whole community is now convinced that we're definitely detecting gravitational waves. But yes, great question. We use simulated sources all the time, by the way, to test out our pipelines, but we also use simulated data. We don't inject them into the strain signal anymore. Yes?
Sorry, why would you wait until after writing?
So that you get the experience. Yes. So you're thinking about minimizing pain, but what if you maximized the pain earlier in the process and then minimized it later? Yes. This is a yes. So we gave ourselves opportunities to yell at each other early on, and that actually did make it go a lot more smoothly, because there are things you don't think about until you're trying to write a compelling paper for why you've detected the first gravitational wave.
What was the result of the vote?
Oh yes, we were all for it. Yes, there was a cake and everything. Yeah.
I think they were very optimistic that you figure out that it is fake, it's not real, up to the last moment. But then they noticed that, no, you're serious to publish it.
Well, yes, happily or unhappily, I'm not sure which I would fall on actually in that camp, but yes, they were all injections, and we gave them names based on where they were in the sky. There's the big dog for Canis Major, and yes, more stories to be had, but we should perhaps forge ahead to leave enough time for Lisa. Oh, one more problem for you. This is actually a really fun one, but I'll skip ahead to the next slides to give you the full context. So I want you to, with your team, we're gonna do a guessing game. So we've got a spectrogram. So this is frequency versus time. This is real gravitational wave strain data, and this is a very nasty detector glitch. And here is a microphone that is housed with the laser system that's witnessing this, as well as a few harmonics above it. So I would like you to just take a minute or two to see if you can reason out what this might be or what might not be. There are a couple people, by the way, who know the answer to this already, so you can tell your friends, but don't shout it out. So they're both real, but so the coupling, what this is telling you is that the coupling between whatever this is and our strain data is not perfect, that some aspect of our noise isolation is working in the higher frequencies where we're not seeing this as strongly. So that means, yes, the coupling is a lot worse at lower frequencies because we're essentially seeing a reproduction of what the microphone is seeing.
I can lost. What's the question again?
We're trying to see if we can guess what this is.
What is the source of this signal?
What is the source of the noise?
Yeah.
Yep. So I've heard some people observing that it's got some structure in time, it's got some structure in frequency.
What is a laser microphone?
So it's like what you have on your phone that will capture your voice.
Yeah,
the audio sensor. Acoustic sensor.
Like you shine a laser into the microphone.
Actually, so the microphone is just hanging out recording sounds.
Uh-huh.
But it happens to live, it happens to be positioned at the same place that our laser source is.
Oh, I see.
Yes. So this is a microphone that's witnessing some noise that's coupling into space-time strain signal. All right, I'll leave you to it. It's not trivial or clear, I think. All right, any guesses? Sorry? Clapping. Well, it is something acoustic. You're right about that. It's definitely a sound. So what I think is a wonderful illustration of our brain's processing power, hope that I have an audio file here. I'm gonna turn my sound. So this was actually a telemarketer. Yes, this happened in the first observing run. This is real data from when LIGO Hanford was observing during the run. We did turn the phone off, so this is a pretty easy fix. But yes, so your ears can resolve this time frequency immediately. And I think that's, our brain is always doing this work. That's our signal processing eyes sometimes have trouble keeping up with. All right, we did fix the phone. And then I've got another challenge for you coming up here. So here's how our sensitivity has evolved as we've improved the performance of the detectors. So we start here with the first observing run in this kind of brown tan color. This is the second observing run where we detected the binary neutron star in blue, and then these Christmas colors down here. So this is Livingston and Hanford in the previous observing run. Gray is sort of where we aspire to be in this current observing run that started on May 24th, but we're not quite there yet. And here is our detection rate. So we started out with one about 2 or 3 months. We got up to, on average, one every about 2 or 3 weeks. Here we're just kind of regressing to the mean. This isn't, we didn't start our new rate early, even though it appears like this. And then we have in O3, roughly a little bit more than one per week. So I have a question for you to think about with your teams. Why do we see these fairly small increases in sensitivity producing such large increases in detection rates? Let's see what we think about that question. And I'll go back to the previous slide. This might be helpful.
Wait, this is a strange.
I mean, the one curve moves to the next curve so that the noise is pushed down a little bit, but across a broad frequency range. Well, I'll give you a hint that, so when I say sensitivity, this is going to directly, linearly increase my reach in one dimension in space. Oh yeah, what was your guess?
I was just guessing you picked up more volume the further away you are.
Yes, exactly. So yes, every time that we increase a little bit in one dimension, that gets cubed. So yes, the effect is really powerful. Yes, it's
striking though. It's just...
Yes, I agree. But yeah, this is something that the particle physics community is usually enamored with because they fight to do 10 times better in some area for a small improvement in overall sensitivity, and we're in the happy to be in the opposite position.
Is O4 the one with Kagura and O5 the one with LIGO?
O4 was supposed to be the one with Virgo and Kagura. It's just the two LIGO detectors right now. Virgo will join in the fall. Kagura will also run, but Kagura's not at a sensitivity where it would be useful to analyze the data. They're focused on pioneering the cryogenics, which I encourage them to do. We really need that figured out.
I'm just wondering why there's such a great ignorance to find the traces O4, which is the gray one, too.
Ah, so O5. So these are just for the LIGO detectors. So Virgo and Kagura, they look a little bit different. So O5 will be an overhaul where we're going to take out our test masses. We're going to put in heavier test masses with different coatings, which we haven't figured out exactly how to coat yet. That's still an open question of what exactly we're going to use for coatings, higher power, and some other big improvements. And that's going to get us to we hope, to the pink curve.
In your example where you had the phone ringing, the way that was actually giving you a signal is that the sound waves, you're picking up it's actually making the interferometer.
I think my understanding of the physical coupling is that it was imprinted onto the laser light as it was exiting the laser and traveling through the interferometer that way. So
that makes it sound like, how can you do anything, right? Why don't the leaves ruffling in the trees? Why doesn't that bother you?
Right. Yes. That was a particularly loud acoustic source, though. It's not often that you have a phone ringing right directly next to your laser source. But, you know, even 10 meters away, the cooling system for the laser, for example, we need to be really careful about acoustic and mechanical coupling of that.
And why did you have a laser microphone?
We have microphones all throughout. We have them as often as we can to get good coverage. So environmental noise is something we worry a lot about in terms of potentially a false candidate.
You just cross-correlate against that and you catch things like that.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Indeed. All right. What do we think about this detection rate? I see many hands. Okay, let's see if we all agree. Yes, we'll start with you.
I'm guessing it has something to do with reducing the noise lets us gather more data, and then we learn more from it, and then we know what to look for better, and still causing this kind of runaway well, not run away, but, like, you know, it's a compounding effect.
You are right that we are learning and our searches are getting better. I will argue that something else is driving the force, the dominant force, but you're right that that's contributing. What do we think down here?
Increasing the detection volume effectively for equal mass events.
Very nice. Yes. So here's a really, really wonderful thing about gravitational waves, is that if I increase the sensitivity by 50%, I push out in one dimension and distance 50% farther, that gets cubed. And so my event rate goes way up really fast with increases in sensitivity. Does this agree with the answers we had over here? Anyone have anything else to add to that? Yeah, nice thinking. Okay, so here we are. We're right at the beginning of O4. So it did begin roughly about a month ago. Just the two detectors in the States are online right now, just the two LIGO detectors. We're hoping Advanced Virgo will join us in the fall. We're moving towards design sensitivity. This is my deputy spokesperson speaking. We're making progress. So Kagura also plans to join. So they have joined at a reduced sensitivity, and now they're back offline trying to work on their cryogenics. So here's just a high-level overview of what we've improved between O3 and O4, and we are doing roughly about 20% better. So we've got stray light combating baffles. We've most importantly got this 300-meter cavity that we've discussed. We've replaced some test masses to have some improved coatings on those surfaces, and we've also upgraded the lasers to ideally move up to a higher input power. There have been some challenges with that too. So what have we done so far since we turned them on May 24th? So if you'd like to, you can go to GraceDB. So this is the Gravitational Wave Event Candidate Database, and actually get these alerts yourself if you'd like to. I think there are even some apps for your phone if you'd like to get immediately notified every time there's a gravitational wave candidate. So here's what we think we've seen so far, just based on what's public. So we've got 5 likely binary black hole candidates, 1 retracted binary black hole candidate, 1 neutron star black hole that actually, strictly speaking, came from slightly before the run started, and then 1 early warning retracted event. So the early warning search is new to this observing run, where you can run your match filter search and then trigger on times that exceed your SNR threshold prior to merger. So this actually triggered a few seconds before the merger time, but we're moving towards being able to alert astronomers maybe even tens of seconds or minutes ahead of a merger, roughly where in the sky the merger will be, and that the merger is coming. So that's very exciting. So you might notice if you add all these numbers up and then compare it to the amount of time we've been running so far that we're not quite beating our event rate in a significant way. Why is that? So Hanford so far has been having a really tough time staying in resonance, so staying locked. And this has to do a lot with our discussion of seismic noise and also how hard it is to run at this higher power, which introduces all kinds of difficulties to maintain that higher power light resonance. But that's something that they're working really hard on. Livingston down here, really carrying the team, doing a great job. Nearly 100% duty cycle, many days, and also at nearly 160 megaparsecs, which is the target for the run. All right, and I always love to emphasize how many people go into building these detectors, commissioning them, doing the noise studies, running the analyses, doing the theory work to make all the models that we rely on. So there's over 1,400 of us, 127 institutions and counting, 19 countries, and it really takes a diversity of expertise and backgrounds to make the collaboration run and to achieve the results that we can achieve. All right, so here we are. I want to foreshadow that with our sensitivity improving and the noise curve marching down, we're getting into really interesting territory for continuous waves. So if we go for a longer period without seeing continuous waves in our galaxy, this is going to start to teach us something very interesting about the neutron star equation of state and the kind of asymmetry that the crust can support. So that's something really potentially fun to watch out for. We're also on the lookout for eccentric binary black holes. So I think we mentioned that gravitational waves tend to circularize the orbits. So the only case where you'd expect to see these is if it's been formed very recently, so dynamically. And this is going to teach us something, if we do see them, about how these systems can form, which is an open question because it's actually kind of tricky to get two compact objects close enough together as compact objects that they can radiate gravitational waves and merge within Hubble time. This is an open question of how this might happen. All right, and then the stochastic background. I'm not going to say very much about this, but we are always looking for a stochastic background. All right, one more time. Let's move one more time. Or do you prefer to stay where you are right now? I see some nodding. Okay, we're done with moving. That's fair enough. How many people talked to somebody that they hadn't really spent a lot of time talking with today? Okay, everybody. Amazing. Mission achieved. All right, and we've got, in our last 30 minutes or so, I'm going to go through this a little bit fast because I really do want us to get to Lisa and Pulsar timing. So future experiments. So I'm going to just summarize the slide as we move into the future, they're going to get bigger. I want you to notice this number. I want you to notice this number, tens of kilometers. And current plans are also for them to get colder. So bigger, colder. We'll introduce a couple of these different designs. So here we are, just to give you a sense of scale. So the detector, 4 kilometers long. Remember how difficult it was for us to see this, even from a drone in the air. We still couldn't see both of the end stations at once. And then the Einstein telescope would be 10 kilometers, and then the Cosmic Explorer would be 40 kilometers. So this is on the scale of the distance between cities. It would be a really mammoth engineering project. So this is a US-based design that's got a lot of Canadian contributors. Einstein Telescope is a European design.
Are they really going to build it in Fredericton?
So this is my reference slide because I happened to be at the CAP meeting and I showed the slide and that's where the CAP meeting was. But you can imagine, yeah, so it who's been to Fredericton? Okay, a few of you. So this is only for you, really. But you can imagine if you started in Fredericton and tried to drive to St. George, about halfway there. That's the size of one of the arms. So are they really going to build it in Canada is, I think, more the relevant question. And I've got some interesting data for you. But first, I want to finish selling you on why this is a good idea. So here we are at the present day, all the way on the right-hand side of this plot. We have reached so far a maximum of about redshift of 1 in terms of the most distant source we've detected so far. A redshift of 2 is about the best we think we can do with the current generation of detectors. But if we were to build Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope, we would see everything, all the way back to the dawn of cosmic time. We would see all of the stellar remnants mergers in the range of about 100 solar masses. So what does this mean? So if you model the astrophysical populations that we think might be out there, so on the left-hand side, each one of these dots is a binary neutron star pair. On the right, the gray are binary black holes. So Cosmic Explorer in particular would give us very nearly all the binary neutron star mergers that we expect. Einstein Telescope would really blow past this into primordial black hole territory that could tell us something really interesting, again, about these potential seeds for intermediate mass black holes. So what I also want to point out are the signal-to-noise ratios. So a significant fraction of these are going to be incredibly high in signal fidelity. So we're going to be able to tease out a lot of these lower SNR features that we've hinted at earlier. So things like eccentricity, spin precession, tidal deformability will be a lot more obvious with these very, very high SNRs. And I'll just show you a quick comparison. So here is the data from the very first detection. If you take the same event, so if you take the same masses and spins, and you generate a simulated signal and simulated data, here's how well you could do with Cosmic Explorer. So instead of a few cycles, now we're seeing thousands of cycles. And this is going to allow us to do tests of general relativity with many, many passes around this extreme space-time curvature of these stellar mass black holes. And also, it will reveal the ring down. So here's where a lot of the really interesting tests of the No-Hair theorem are. And since we only have 30 minutes left, I'm going to ask you to ask Luis about that, because this is one of his specialties. So that's a very exciting prospect. And I also wanted to mention just a little bit about dense matter and neutron stars. So we talked some about tidal deformability. So depending on the neutron star equation of state, so here these different colors are representing different assumed and modeled neutron star equations of state. They produce very different signals. And all of them right now are below this noise curve. So this is our current limit for ground-based detectors. Where we're trying to get is here, or equivalently. You can see this also in this plot for Cosmic Explorer in pink, Einstein Telescope in green, and also one model for a binary neutron star equation of state, which I think is ALF2. So were we to build these, we would be learning immediately new information about tidal deformability and this really rich structure in neutron stars. Okay, and here's a question for you. So you might be thinking, that all sounds great, but as you were saying, where would we put this thing? 40 kilometers in two directions. And one of the key questions here that we need to deal with is we have to have our laser flying in a straight line. And at the scale of 40 kilometers, the curvature of the Earth gets in the way in a really serious fashion. So here's a question for you to think about with your team. What is the height of delta Z that's 20 kilometers away from one of your test messes? How much height is the curvature of the Earth introducing if you just follow this 0 meters in elevation? Yes.
The dimension of the curvature.
What do you mean? Well, I suppose we could think about it angularly, or sure, we could use those units. We could use those units, yeah. Oh, I thought you said arcsec. Oh, okay. Yeah, you could. So if you were going to sketch this out, what you might do is exactly as you're, I think, proposing, where you're taking a slice out of a circle and thinking about, okay, if I dissect that slice of a circle in this particular area, what's going to be the peak height? I think that would probably be easier. Yes. Yeah, any guesses with that in mind?
6,400 kilometers is the radius of the Earth.
That's right.
Times
40 kilometers.
What is the theta for it? That 40 kilometers?
40 over 6,400. Over 6. So
that would be.
I feel like I have to just write this down. Right?
Yes, yeah. I think we're at the same position here.
Or 10 meters, so I guess. So
you can do it along the one of the circles that is parallel to equator on 4 kilometers.
Yeah. Ah, like a longitude, latitude. Yeah.
So that would change, right? If you could do it.
That's strictly speaking, you know, you're right. The curvature does change a little bit depending on the latitude.
Okay.
But that's a higher order effect that I'm not expecting you to include. I was actually thinking people would probably just guess, but everyone is calculating it, which is wonderful. Sorry? Yeah. It is. Yes. All right. Sorry to interrupt those of you who are still calculating. We're starting to get answers down here at the front of the room, and I see we only have 25 minutes left. So I wonder if folks might like to share your guesses. I see many hands. Yes. What are we thinking?
So we got 30.
30. We got 30 down here too. That is true. 30.
31. We got.
Okay, so the best fit, yes. Fair enough. All right, so let's assume that the height of this is 30 meters at the peak. So here are some fun facts for you. So assuming a 4 meter platform width and the shape as shown, and also a fun fact, relatively cheap to move dirt around per square meter. However, when you introduce many, many, many square meters, the price tag starts to get very big. So if you were to excavate 40 kilometers in two directions, you'd actually multiply this number by 2. And now we're approaching about $1 billion. So we don't want to do that. What we want to do is be clever and choose a concave natural geometry such that our laser will fly straight with minimal digging. So if we reduce the amount that we have to dig, then we could potentially reduce this price tag of just making the arms by 2 orders of magnitude. So here's a cool analysis done by Francois Skitkat at the University of Montreal. So essentially this is taking Google Maps data and looking at the geometry of the land and finding sites that are potentially promising in terms of amount of earth that has to be dug. So red is actually the best here. So we're finding the sites and also finding the orientations. So I'll show you this for North America, and then I will also show you this for Canada. And those of you very familiar with Canada might notice that this is aligned with the Canadian Shield, which is very seismically stable. So Canada actually looks very promising if you're, as to your point, just thinking about the best science that you can do. The politics and the money, you know, maybe not a Canadian site. But one thing that I think Canada could do a really good job contributing to is that any of these sites are all going to have a lot of overlap with Indigenous territories, and Canada has a lot of experience working with these communities, and we'd really want to weave this into the foundation of site selection from the very earliest stages to build those kinds of partnerships. Okay, and now we finally get to Lisa. We still have more than 20 minutes, so I'm going to call that a win. So I expect if Thursday's announcement is what I anticipate it may be, that we're about to enter the era of multi-wavelength gravitational wave astronomy, which is very analogous to multi-wavelength electromagnetic astronomy. So where LIGO, Virgo, and ground-based detectors are at the highest frequencies, so these are the lowest mass sources. And then LISA is one step below that. So these are going to be supermassive black holes eating things, supermassive black holes orbiting each other, but on the lower mass end of the spectrum. And then there's also pulsar timing. So these are the largest supermassive black holes that are very, very slowly orbiting around each other at the early stages of galaxy mergers. That's this kind of signal. And then on the scale of billions of years, we mentioned that gravitational waves from the Big Bang would be redshifted. So this is a captured and essentially a still shot in the CMB polarization. So that, yes?
The only difference between LISA and LIGO is the arm lengths.
And seismic.
Yes, well, you're about to find out. We're gonna get, a nice visual. So yes, you are right that the arm length is very different. So instead of 40 kilometers, here we've got 2.5 million kilometers. So on the scale of the solar system. And this is going to unlock, together with not having any seismic noise to worry about, this is gonna unlock sensitivity to those very low frequency sources. So it will fly in a triangular configuration with 3 spacecraft that are orbiting roughly about 20 to 30 degrees behind the Earth. And they're gonna be rotating in a cartwheel. So by the way, the planets and distance between them are not exactly to scale. This is mostly to kind of impress you with the vision that this is a solar system scale observatory. But we'll take a little bit of a more detailed look at how it works. But before we do that, I'd like you to think about this thought question. So remember how we defined gravitational wave strain and quadrupole moments. So consider 2 black holes at an equal distance, or 2 black hole binaries, that's an important distinction, at an equal distance from us, the observer, with the same orbital separation and roughly circular orbits. So if system A is a total mass of 1,000 and system B is a total mass of 100, which system is going to emit higher amplitude gravitational waves? Maybe we can just shout this out together. Is it going to be system A or is it going to be system B? Yes, I heard A. That is true. So the higher the mass involved, the greater, if they're moving at the same speed, the greater that quadrupole moment term is going to be. So with this in mind, this is our intuition, higher mass systems. We also saw this from the selection effects plot that we were looking at. We're more sensitive to higher mass systems. So here's the question for you, for your teams. Why doesn't LIGO observe black hole mergers with total mass greater than about 250 solar masses? If they're so loud, Why do we not see them? And here's a hint that you may also find this formula useful. This is a great big pull from earlier in the day.
Because of the frequency.
Okay, we'll work this out together. I love that. Yes.
Sorry.
So there are two elements here. I hear people shouting out exactly the right things to be thinking about. So we're limited in our low frequency sensitivity. We've got a wall, and anything that's lower than that wall in frequency, we will not see it. So what this is telling us, this equation, if you work through the math with the numbers of for the total masses at least as sources, for example, they're never going to make it above the seismic noise wall in terms of frequency. They're going to merge before they hit that seismic wall. So they are many orders of magnitude stronger, actually. LISA is a less sensitive instrument. It's got a milliwatt laser, and it just flings it off into space in the other direction. They don't worry about shot noise. They're about three orders of magnitude less sensitive. But their sources are much higher in amplitude, but also in a way that we'll never sense them on Earth. All right, here's a lightning tour. We've already said most of these facts, but the frequency range for LISA, so it's about 100 millihertz to about a hertz. So what this means also for these low frequency sources is that they're going to be in band for a very long time. So we've been thinking about the transient case where the signal sweeps into your data and then is merged very quickly. So here we're going to have sources that are months or years long, and some will be present throughout the entire observing run for LISA, which we hope will be a 10-year extended mission. And here's a quick tour of the discovery space that we're expecting to see. So we've got this characteristic strain amplitude. We've got a noise curve that the shape may look very familiar to you, with these funny bumps in it that we can talk about if we'd like. And on top of that, we've projected the expected sources that we think we will see. So each one of these dots is a white dwarf binary. And they have very particular frequencies that are not going to evolve very much over the course of the mission. And the SNR, so the color here, represents the signal to noise ratio of these binaries. So there are a few dots here with circles around them. So those are what we call verification binaries that we're going to use to calibrate the LISA data. And then above all of this, you can also see this pattern that you may remember from LIGO, binary black hole mergers. So these are the supermassive black hole mergers. And just check out the scale of the strain for a total mass of about 10 to the 7th. So here now the strain is about 10 to the minus 16, or very nearly. So much, much louder, much higher amplitude signals, but that again merge well before the LIGO frequency range. All right, I have one thing that I'd like you to think about here. Well, actually, let's see. Would you like to talk about verification binaries, or should we motor forward towards pulsar timing? What do we think?
Actually, one short question to that.
Sure.
Like, what frequency do you expect to see these like long events? Because if you have a lot of overlapping events, it might be difficult to differentiate signals.
Absolutely. So you can see a sense of the frequency spread here. So the verification binaries are going to be a great big mess. We may not be able to resolve individual binaries except for those with the highest SNR, unless we know where they are exactly in the sky. So I've sort of revealed the answer here. So why have we identified verification binaries, but they're not necessarily the highest SNR that we're expecting? So these are the ones where we already know where they are. They're hard to find with telescopes. They're very dim. But if you can identify a white dwarf binary in the sky and you can anticipate exactly what the amplitude modulation is going to be from LISA's orbit, then you can use that as a direct calibrator. But yes, so this is going to be a mess. That's a technical term. This is going to be really tough to disentangle. And then you also have the frequency components for all of these transient sources that are evolving slightly over time as they're moving towards merger. All right, it's a good question. And a question that I have anticipated on a later slide. I will summarize this slide very quickly. How does LISA work exactly? So each one of those spacecraft has two lasers, and very importantly, each one of those lasers has a reference laser. So we don't actually reflect any light in LISA. It only ever flies one way. It starts out as a millihertz laser with a beam width of about this big, and then it flies out to be about 30 meters in diameter by the time it gets to 2.5 million kilometers away, which is actually a benefit. It makes it a little bit easier for them to align and for us to keep them aligned. But the interferometry part of the laser interferometer space antenna comes from this reference laser. So we've got the system, it's emitting a laser, it's also catching a laser that it's receiving from the other spacecraft, and it's comparing the phase that it's receiving to its reference laser. And this is how we're performing the interferometry. So we're not comparing light that we're splitting with the beam splitter and reflecting, we're relying on our very accurate and sensitive reference lasers here to sense those relative differences. All right, I think I'll skip over this one. It's a fun thing to think about if you'd like to think about it. We do expect that the noise curves would look very much the same here. This is also a super fun exercise to do that maybe we'll come back to if we have some time. But right, so your point about overlapping signals. So this is a recent paper that was published by Cornish and Littenberg. So essentially what they hypothesize is that if you can simulate your noise plus your persistent signals plus your transient signals, you can start to detangle this problem in advance, because we know we're going to have thousands, if not millions, of signals in the data at the same time. So what they've done is they've generated this noise that you can see back here in gray. They've also generated some of these persistent sources. So the verification white dwarf binaries are in orange. You'll notice that these are all sinusoidal, essentially. They barely move over the duration of the observing run, which is about 4 years. And then they also have this evolution of multiple binary black hole sources of varying amplitudes in the data. And what they've proposed to do is this hierarchical global fit method, where you're fitting together all of your binary black hole sources, all of your white dwarf binary sources, and your noise all at the same time. You're modeling that, and then you subtract it out, and then you repeat. So you pull off each layer. You start with the highest SNR layer that's the easiest to model, and then you reveal the lower SNR signals and noise in your data. You do the modeling again. You repeat this process essentially until you have nothing that your configuration is able to resolve. And what's really nice about this infrastructure is that you can add these in a very modular way. So let's say if we have this other type of source, so this happens to be something one of the PhD students at UBC that my group is working on, they're called hierarchical triples, where you have a stellar mass black hole binary that's itself in orbit around a supermassive black hole. And it doesn't do this nice F dot that's slowly increasing as they emerge. It goes bang, bang, bang as it whizzes around the supermassive black hole at an eccentricity that's approaching one. So this is something that hasn't really been well studied, but once there is a good model for it, it would be pretty straightforward to add to this global fit type approach. So this is where the community is thinking about heading. It's going to take a lot more work in terms of modeling types of sources that maybe we haven't thought about so much yet, or improving our numerical relativity to the point that we're able to resolve some of these very, very high SNR sources that LISA's going to see. And that's also a problem for Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope. All right, questions about many, many sources overlapping? It's a really tough problem. All right, sounds like we're feeling good about that. So one thing that's wonderful about LISA is this multi-messenger astronomy aspect. So LISA is going to be able to probe out to redshifts of 20 and beyond, depending on what the mass of the source is. And we're also compiling very detailed galaxy catalogs where we can identify, even in advance, really promising candidates for galaxy mergers. So we should be able to identify galaxies in the process of merging, galaxies that have recently merged, and use that LISA data to trace out what we think we know about galaxy evolution and how this follows the growth of the supermassive black hole as those galaxies are merging together. So this is, I think, a really, really interesting application for multi-messenger astronomy. And then you see we've made it to pulsar timing in the last 10 minutes. So go team. We did it. So here we're back to the gravitational wave spectrum. So we've talked about terrestrial interferometers. We've talked about supernovas. We've talked about pulsars. So this means spinning neutron stars with a little mountain. We've talked about CBCs. We've haven't talked so much about extreme mass ratio or EMRIs. In spirals for LISA sources, essentially what this is you have some stellar mass objects. This could be a black hole, could be a neutron star. but it's making thousands and thousands of passes through this really deep gravity well of the supermassive black hole, which will be an entirely complementary and very powerful test of general relativity to ground-based detectors. And this brings us here down to pulsar timing. So all the way at the lowest frequency range where we have the most massive supermassive black holes, and we're starting to see these redshift effects from supermassive black holes in the earlier universe. Okay, so how do they work? So instead of a solar system scale detector, now we have a galaxy scale detector, where what we're gonna do is we're gonna pick some of our favorite, most reliable pulsars that are scattered around the galaxy around Earth, and we look for these very tiny correlations in differences in the time of arrival. So these correlated timing differences are going to allow us to treat them essentially like rubber ducks in the pond. They're going to ebb and flow up and down as space-time is stretching and squeezing around them. And if you look at them as a correlated network, we should be able to, in this frequency range, tease out those very low frequency signals. And someone mentioned earlier in the meeting over coffee about how important it is to make sure that you understand the light path between the pulsar and Earth. So for example, other objects in the solar system, the light is going to be bending around those gravitational wells, wells as well, and this is something that they need to account for in this measurement. And this is a truly international effort. So you can see telescopes from the US, telescopes from Europe, telescopes from Australia, formerly Arecibo as well. But Canada has actually been a real powerhouse in this effort. So the Chime Observatory in BC has filled a lot of the data for the Northern Hemisphere that Arecibo was providing and beyond. So Chime gets sort of for free measurements, really detailed measurements of how these pulsars are evolving over time, over the course of every day. And this is something that I really wanted to cover. So I can't tell you any secrets, mostly because I don't know them myself. I'm just as excited about you are as you are about what they might say on Thursday. But this is a prediction based on population synthesis modeling for potential sources about when they might have accrued enough data to see a stochastic gravitational wave background. So this would be an unresolvable background of all of these supermassive black hole binaries, including the redshifted supermassive black hole binaries. And we've excluded a very strong gravitational wave background, so that would have been in 2021, but moderate, so sort of nominal expected gravitational wave background. Take a look at this time. So it's right at about 2023. So right about now. So if that is the announcement on Thursday, then this is right on schedule in terms of where the community thought they might be if the universe and the cosmos were behaving as they were expecting it to. All right, so I want to leave you with this thought. So I want to compare gravitational wave astrophysics to the first use of a telescope. So this is Galileo's first sketch of Saturn all the way back in 1610. And this is our first detection of a gravitational wave. And 6 years later, which is roughly where we are for gravitational wave astronomy, so now we have 90 candidates, black holes, neutron stars, a mix of both. And by this time, Galileo had recognized that Saturn has rings. So just imagine where we're going to be in the next decades or even hundreds of years from now. This is a technology and a science that's really just beginning, and it has a lot of potential. So with that, wow, we even have 5 minutes for questions. Amazing. So thank you all very much. It's been such a pleasure to work with you all. You're a wonderful group. My pleasure, yes.
We got a lot of questions out of them during that time.
We did. Did anybody learn anything particularly surprising?
Hope there is no birds in space.
I want that on a t-shirt. Yes.
No, I'm not going to say anything. Can we turn off the recording, please?
Because it's going to probably talk about that before, I'm pretty sure, but I mean, there are a lot of
pings in space, right? For Lisa, something can hit it and everything can go away. So how are you planning to deal with those kind of problems?
Anytime.
What was that? I didn't understand that either. What was the answer?
AI.
Oh, AI. Well, there is that, I suppose. But I want to tell you about micro-Newton thrusters. All right, so you're right that if left to their own devices, when we position three spacecraft 2.5 million kilometers apart, they're going to drift. And not only are they going to drift, yes, you might get a burst of radiation pressure from the sun, you might get cosmic rays, you might, yeah, there are a lot of things. We need to be able to steer these things in order to keep the lasers pointed in the right direction. We need to be able to shield them from the sources that we do expect. So the community, recognizing this, sent a precursor mission up in space called LISA Pathfinder that was meant to test our ability to shield from these kind of sources and also to test these micro-Newton thrusters that are going to steer the spacecraft around so that the lasers are pointed in the right direction, that we're able to do interferometry with all six laser interfaces. So the Pathfinder mission really blew away the specs. So it had a set noise specification to achieve, and then it went so far down beyond that it actually beat the LISA mission specifications. So we think of that as proven technology now. We are going to be able to steer these things around in a way that's not going to be adding noise to the measurements.
Yeah, that's
yes, and the, yes, sorry.
I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. And also, for instance, let's take this scenario, which is, I think, quite likely to happen. We send them off, and they are there. Everything is working pretty good, and suddenly something went wrong, and now we can't receive signals. What's going to happen?
Well, we're definitely in a James Webb situation. It's going to be too far to send somebody out there. Definitely.
So then everything is just going to be just...
I don't think so. So there's a lot of robustness in this model. So you can still make measurements with one laser arm working. So we've got two. We've got some degeneracy there. Every arm has two lasers. We also have three arms. So I'll tell you a little bit of history that you may not want to know, but it was very formative for me as a PhD student. So back in, I think it was 2012, 2011, NASA backed out of the LISA project. This was before the first discovery of gravitational waves. So the European Space Agency, who's leading the mission, was like, oh, okay, we'll just have two. So you won't have an omnidirectional basis, but you know, let's say something horrible happens to one spacecraft, we'll still get some science out of this. And if something bad happens to one laser, we still have three arms. We can still do most of the science we want to do.
Thanks.
Yes, good question though.
I think even if something wrong happens, but before that we detect something, then you can persuade people to send another one. But mission that human is going towards that. It's even you need more accuracy than sending people to Mars for this.
We definitely need to send you to Congress.
Risk is there. I mean, they are sending humans up there, and something might go wrong.
But there are some unfortunate events in history too.
Yeah, I mean, that's
not
among
those.
So, if you want to discover the universe, that is.
Yes.
That's a really question already, in a way we didn't expect it.
Well, I'll maybe leave you with this. So, James Webb has also experienced unexpected difficulties. They've had broken pixels. They have challenges in instrumentation, and they're learning to deal with the instrument that they have. We too, I am optimistic, will be able to learn to deal with the instrument that we have.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question. Yes?
What's a funny story about noise?
What's a funny story about noise? I was. All right, this is going to sound like a knock-knock joke or something, but
sure.
Well, maybe not in the context that it involves a grad student doing all the work of figuring it out, so never mind. There was a source of noise, and we could see it at 60 hertz. We could only see it at one of the end stations, so we could see it in magnetometers. We could see it in the voltage monitors, and it would happen roughly about once an hour. Right on schedule, very regularly, about once an hour. And as the weather got colder, we started seeing it farther and farther apart. And this was very mysterious until a very intrepid
a pioneering graduate student went out with a handheld magnetometer and waited for one of these things to happen, and then waited for the next one and started localizing it to a refrigerator that was drawing power as it was kicking on its cycle. So it was full of cold water for people coming out of the vacuum chamber in bunny suits. So we didn't need it to be cold. We unplugged it. That solved the problem. I don't know if that was funny, but...
How long did it take to figure it out?
About 4 months.
This one I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yes?
Maybe one more question about Lisa, because I assume the 90 degree angle of LIGO is like the optimal one to detect gravitational wave. How much physics do you lose because you have a 60 degree angle? Or am I completely wrong?
You're right that there's an important difference. So if you build an L shape, this is the way to maximize the possible signal to noise ratio you could accumulate with an optimal orientation of the source to the detector. So if it's coming right directly overhead, that's the maximal SNR you'll get is with the L shaped detector, because the orthogonal, yes. So the triangular detector, this gets you omnidirectional sensitivity to the sky. You have no blind spots. That's the big benefit. That's also why Einstein Telescope is planning to build a triangular design. However, you lose a little bit of opportunity cost in that the maximum total SNR you can build up is a little bit less. So it's a trade-off.
But if the gravitational wave comes from the same plane, like if this is the plane, and could you observe that with Lisa?
Yes, you can. And you can observe it with the L-shaped detectors as well. But with Lisa, yes, you have a little bit less sensitivity.
Okay.
Yeah, good question. All right, are we all ready for Friday to become the weekend? If you have other questions, so I'm going to be around for approximately 10 minutes. You're welcome to come ask me. Or I actually forgot that I'd included this. There is a page here. I will send these slides to you so that you can all have access to this. There are a lot of really great ways to get involved. So if you're keen to keep thinking about gravitational wave astrophysics, there's a focus group led by Philandri at CETA. This is totally open access. Anyone can come and join and chat with us. The Cosmic Explorer Consortium is totally open. The Gravitational Wave Open Science Center has a whole bunch of tutorials and web courses that really walk you through the analysis. There's a lot of resources for the LISA Canada workshops that will introduce you to the LISA detectors and the science cases and all the different aspects of the consortium. So I encourage you to reach out to me or any one of these resources if you're interested. And yeah, thank you again. This was a really lovely day today.